And now we come to the living Word of God. And today in our series in Acts, we're up to Acts chapter 21, verses 17 to 36. Acts 21, 17 to 36, as you'll see on the meeting program you were given on the way in. And that's on page 875 of the Church Bibles. And you'll need that open as we get down to work now and dig into it. If anyone needs a Bible, do stick up a hand and Caleb can bring you one. So, Caleb, can we have a Bible at the front here? Any others? Great. And at this point in the book, we're now really getting into the final stretch, the final stages of this amazing saga that we've been in for the best part of a year. And Jesus himself promised at the very beginning, if you remember all the way back in chapter 1, verse 8, what would happen, and we've watched it happening. So the gospel explodes in Jerusalem, that's chapters 1 to 7, then floods out into the surrounding areas of Judea, Samaria, chapters 8 to 12, and then starts spreading out to the ends of the earth, chapters 13 to the end of the book. And the ends of the earth in Acts is symbolized by the city of Rome, the biggest, most international city on the planet, many hundreds of miles from Jerusalem. And today's passage, here's why I say we're sort of just the beginning of the end. This is the point at the waterfall as you pause and then you plunge down. And the reason I say that is today's passage has the chain of events which will finish with the Apostle Paul doing accomplishing his mission, making it to Rome. It begins today. And so the question as we hear the reading now is this for each of us. If you had to pick out an implicit warning from the first half of the reading for us, what would it be? What might the author Luke be implicitly warning us to avoid or about in the first half of the reading today? Have a think about that as you hear the reading now. Let me hand over to Tess. Great, here's Tess. Page 875, Acts 21, 17 to 36. Thanks, Tess.
When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God. And they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews who those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses, so that they may shave their heads. Thus, all we know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself also live in observance of the law. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols and from blood and what has been strangled and from sexual immorality. Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them and went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, 'Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone, everywhere, against the people and the law in this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came up to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him."
That's great. Thank you very much, Tess. As we start, can I ask a favor? Could someone grab me a water from the table at the back? I'm parched, and that will help all of us. Thank you. Let's pray. Some words from Joshua 1. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Lord, thank you for the book you have given us. Lord, all of the revelation you've given us, by extension including books like Luke's record for us of the actions of your son after he ascended. Lord, help us to meditate on this book now, together, me included, as we unpack it, so that we may be careful to do everything written in it. Help us to be obedient. Lord, so that we can be prosperous and successful in honoring you, in bearing fruit for your kingdom, in loving each other, in growing in love and joy and peace and strength and hope. Thank you that that is your promise when we come to your word. And please glorify yourself by fulfilling it now. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, Mike. I've ever been involved in a church split or major conflict in church. I time my drink then to give you guys a few seconds to meditate on that truly awful reality. Church splits are horrendous. They're draining, they're distressing, they're dishonoring to God, they're incredibly painful, and they happen. They happen. In today's passage, Luke is giving us two contrasting pictures, and the first, in verses 17 to 26, is a picture of unity within the church, and that's our first point, internal unity. Because the early church at this stage is basically a powder keg waiting to erupt in what would have been a horrific church split. When Paul arrives in Jerusalem, this potential catastrophe is hanging over the church, the global church. And the wisdom and the godliness of Paul and the other leaders has good things to teach us about preserving and strengthening the beautiful unity that the Lord has so far blessed us with here in Emmanuel that we mustn't take for granted. So let's start with the encouragement. The encouragement. Let me read again from verse 17. When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. It's a dramatic scene. The scene opens with the leader of Gentile Christianity, Paul, who's just done years of circuits around the Mediterranean, the known world, missionary journeys, and the leader of Jewish Christianity, James, who's the head of the church in Jerusalem, and these two great heavyweights come face to face. And they're each accompanied by representatives of their own areas. So Paul's got companions with him from the Gentile churches, including Luke, who's writing this. And James has got the elders of the Jerusalem church with him. So you can picture them both with their entourages, like their own people. And as we'll see shortly in verse 21, a false rumor had been going around that Paul was basically anti-Jewish. On top of that, in the words of one commentator, and this should come up on the slides, some people, probably the same people spreading the false rumor, were doubtless asserting that the doctrinal positions of James and Paul were incompatible, as they had done before the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15, 1 and 2. Paul teaching salvation by grace, James salvation by works. Next slide. So the meeting of these two great apostles, leaders of, of the different factions of the global church, each with their entourages, is a huge moment, and it's fraught with risk. And I think it would have been quite tense. Like, is there going to be a confrontation? Rumors have been going around that Paul's anti-Jewish. That's the elephant in the room. Is James going to raise it? If so, how? How's that going to go? Well, here's the encouragement. Look at verse 19. We're holding our breath. What's going to happen? Verse 19, after greeting them. So Paul greets James and the elders. You can see his posture there. He, Paul, related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So Paul's not going on an ego trip and taking personal credit for all the fruit. His ministry update is all about what the Lord has done. Verse 20, and when they, James and the Jerusalem elders, heard it, they glorified God. See, they've got a very generous posture too. They're not disapproving. They're not disbelieving. They're not cynical. They're not jealous. They have immediate, spontaneous, genuine joy at what's been happening through Paul. They glorify God. And with their very next words, I love this tiny detail, they call Paul their, do you see what they call him? Their brother. But then the Jerusalem elders do have to raise the tricky subject of Paul's alleged anti-Jewishness. So here's the problem, reading on from verse 20. And they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. Okay, so there are two issues here. Number one, Moses, the law, and number two, circumcision. First of all, Moses. Well, Paul had been arguing that obeying the law of Moses wasn't needed for salvation. That is, he had been preaching that faith alone is all that's needed for salvation. And we know James agreed with that. But Paul hadn't been teaching people to forsake the customs of Moses, such as Jewish food laws. In fact, quite the opposite. At the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, Paul had happily supported James's proposal that Gentile Christians should not break the law of Moses to avoid causing cultural offense to their Jewish brothers and sisters. And the second issue was circumcision. And in the same way, yes, okay, Paul had been arguing that circumcision wasn't needed for salvation, but James agreed with that. In other words, that Gentile Christians didn't need to undergo it. But once again, Paul had never forbidden it as a custom, as proved by the fact that he himself had circumcised Timothy back in chapter 16. And once again, he did that to avoid causing cultural offense to Jews who they were about to go and witness to. So when the elders say that all of the Jewish converts are, quote, zealous for the law, end of verse 20, that cannot mean that they're zealous for the law in terms of zealous to keep it in order to earn salvation. Because just look before that in verse 20. Here's the giveaway. These Jewish converts are, quote, those who have believed. They knew they were saved by faith. That is not the issue here. So their zeal for the law is just a zeal for personal holiness and godliness and a cultural zeal for the customs of the law. Partly a cultural issue. Look at the last word of verse 21. That's the issue here. Is Paul anti-Jewish in terms of wantonly trashing Jewish customs that were precious to Jewish people who'd lived in them for centuries? No. He's anti anything other than salvation by grace alone through faith alone. He's anti claims that salvation can be by circumcision or obeying Moses. And James and the Jerusalem elders agree with him on that. But in terms of Jewish customs, like circumcision, as long as you're not trusting in it for salvation, or the law of Moses, as long as you're not trusting in it for salvation, in terms of Jewish customs, Paul is not anti-Jewish. So how can this rumor be dispelled before it causes this terrible split, this terrible conflict between Jewish and Gentile Christians, and before it damages the witness to not yet Jewish, not yet Christians who are Jewish? What can be done? As the elders say in verse 22, quote, what then is to be done? They, the people who think you're anti-Jewish, will certainly hear that you have come. And so that brings us on to the solution reading from verse 23. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. So they were likely under a Nazarite vow as per Numbers chapter 6 in the Old Testament. And this vow would end when the person cut their hair and then presented it as an offering in the temple. And that's actually the same vow that Paul put himself under back in chapter 18, if you remember, which proves again he isn't against keeping the customs of the law. And the elders' thinking is that if Paul goes with these guys to fulfill the vow that they're under and even personally pays for them to fulfill it himself, that will demonstrate once and for all that he isn't against Jewish customs. He isn't anti-Jewish in that sense. As they go on in verse 24, thus all will know that there is nothing in what they've been told about you, but that you yourself also live in observance of the law. And then the final loose end to tie up is what to say to the many thousands of Gentile Christians around the known world at this point. Because the elders don't, the Jerusalem elders don't want them provoking or hurting their Jewish Christian brothers and sisters or Jewish non-Christians who they should be witnessing to by being culturally insensitive and trashing Jewish customs. Hence verse 25, they say, but as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what has been strangled and from sexual immorality. Now, if that gives you a sense of deja vu, it should. We covered all of that back in chapter 15. That is just the exact same things that they told the Gentile Christians with Paul's warm support at the beginning of chapter 15. So they're effectively saying to the Gentile Christians, look, when you're among your Jewish brothers and sisters or Jewish non-Christians who you should be witnessing, just be sensitive. They're saying, be willing to forego your own freedom to avoid treading on their toes culturally. So just don't buy meat from the market that was previously sacrificed in a pagan temple. You're free to, but we're asking you not to avoid offending your Jewish fellow Christians. Don't buy meat with the blood still in it. Don't eat the meat of an animal that was strangled, and don't commit sexual immorality. And we might think, well, wait, that last one isn't cultural. It's sinful. No Christian should be committing sexual immorality. And that's true. But Jews typically had much, much higher standards of sexual purity than Gentiles. Most of the Gentile world was incredibly sexually depraved at this point. And so that fourth thing is probably needed saying because of how far back Gentile converts were coming from in that area. The letter's effectively saying you Gentile Christians shouldn't be committing sexual immorality anyway, but especially don't, because on top of being sinful and offensive to God, it's incredibly culturally sinful to your fellow Jewish Christians who have higher standards in that area culturally than you've come from. And then the beautiful ending to this little episode is that Paul is only too happy to acquiesce and go with the elders' requests, even at personal significant financial cost. Verse 23. He didn't have to, but he forgoes his freedom, and he does it. Verse 26. Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them, and so on. So what for us? Well, here's the principle. Are we sensitive to the preferences and customs and cultural commitments of others? And where those customs don't contradict the gospel and aren't sin, are we willing to forego our own freedom to do things how we like to do them to avoid causing disunity between us and other believers, to avoid putting a stumbling block in front of other unbelievers who we're trying to witness to? Here's how Paul summarized his own example in this principle in 1 Corinthians 9. He said, to the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not myself being under the law, that I might win those under the law. to those outside the law, like the Gentiles. I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ. He's saying I'm not an antinomian, I'm not anarchic. I want to obey God and be holy. But I'm going to be as one outside the law. They're tucking into Sunday steak that was bought from the meat market that had previously been sacrificed to a pagan god. I'll tuck in with them because I'm not going to make an issue of it. I know it's not sin. I'm going to be like one of them, that I might win those outside the law. Verse 22, to the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people so that by all means I might save some. Well, once again, let me ask, what does this look like for us? Not too many pagan meat markets around Knoxville the last time I looked at Google Maps. Well, I read about a respectable middle-class church a while back in which one Sunday morning, just as the service was beginning, a young college student walked in. And this guy was barefoot, had very long hair, pretty unkempt. And when he walked in, he couldn't see a free seat. And so he just sat down on the floor in the aisle, which was kind of his style anyway. And just as everyone else in the room started to feel a little awkward about this, I think we would, wouldn't we, if that had happened this morning, and trying not to stare, just at that moment, an old man in the congregation who was known for being very traditional started to walk towards the young guy with a troubled look on his face. He's got his jacket on, his tie, and everyone started cringing at the embarrassing rebuke that they knew was coming. And when the man got up to him, he paused, and then with great physical difficulty lowered himself onto the floor next to the student and spent the rest of the service there. Imagine that someone in Emmanuel is teetotal. They don't do alcohol at all, never have. When I have them to dinner in my home, even if there's nothing more I would love than a cold beer at that moment, I'm going to lay down my freedom out of my love for them. I'm going to do things their way, not mine. Imagine that a woman from the Middle East starts attending Emmanuel, and because of their cultural background, I soon notice that they don't do physical contact with men in social situations. Out of my love for them, I'm going to be tactful, and I'm going to remember not to make them uncomfortable by clumsily offering them my hand as a Westerner. I'm going to do things their way, not mine. Imagine that someone else in Emmanuel has very, very different politics to me, or a very different attitude towards guns, or very different attitudes towards immigration. I'm just trying to pick all of the most sensitive issues I can, because that's where this bites. Or a very different attitude towards homeschool versus public school versus Christian school. Or a very different anything. I do not have to agree with them, but if their view isn't clearly sinful or denies the gospel, then even if I know they're wrong and I know I'm right, I'm going to lay down my freedom to push my opinion if it's going to be an issue. Because either they're my brother or sister for whom Christ died, and I'm not going to damage my unity with them over something less important than the gospel, or they're not. And I'm not going to put a stumbling block between them and the gospel they so desperately need. I think we get the idea. Well, after this first picture of internal unity, avoiding that split, second and finally, we get a picture of external attack. External attack. And this is in verses 27 to 36. And if you look closely in these verses, there are two big contrasts going on in them. There's injustice and justice, and then there's chaos and control. So first of all, let's look at the injustice versus the justice. And here we see Jewish injustice contrasted with Roman justice. A reading from verse 27. When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him, Paul, in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd. Notice their cynical tactics. They're playing dirty by stirring up the crowd. And laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who's teaching everyone, everywhere, against the people and the law and this place, the temple. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." So they've got two charges against Paul in verse 28. The first being that he's teaching against the people of Israel and the law of Moses and the temple, which was a willful misunderstanding. It was the same charge that the Jews had against Stephen back in chapter 6 before they murdered him, and against Jesus back in the Gospels before they murdered him. Because Jesus had spoken of himself as the fulfillment of the people and the law and the temple. And that was the gospel faithfully echoed by Stephen and now Paul. And so that wasn't trashing the people and the law and the temple. That was in fact revealing their true meaning, their true glory. And it's ironic that actually Paul is grabbed by these rabble-rousers in the very act of purifying himself in the temple so he wouldn't desecrate it. So that first charge is unfair. And then the second charge in verse 28 is that Paul brought Greeks, in other words, Gentiles, into the part of the temple where only Jews were allowed. And then Luke explains in verse 29 that this was also a false assumption by them and that Paul hadn't. But the fact these two charges are unfounded doesn't stop the ringleaders from performing a citizen's arrest, grabbing Paul physically in verse 27, and then the mob that they've stirred up, grabbing him in verse 30, and dragging him out of the temple and trying to kill him. I can see some of them starting to lay into him with fists, maybe holding him by the scruff of his neck, and others go off to find rocks to stone him. And when the Romans intervene so they can investigate and find out the truth, you know what the Jews' level of interest in the truth is? It's the last three words of verse 36. That's how open they are to rational, fair argument at this point. Get him out of here! That's their argument. The Romans, so that's Jewish injustice. The Romans, by contrast, intervene in verse 32 to prevent an extrajudicial killing, then try to investigate the truth about Paul in verse 33, and when they're prevented from that, take further steps to ensure that that investigation can happen, verses 34, 35. And did you notice all of the parallels between the Jews and the Romans in the way that Luke has told this? I saw this just last night, and it's amazing to me, Luke's cleverness as a writer, not just a historian, he's a master of literature and a theologian. So look at the parallels. The Greek verb for the crowd seizing Paul in verse 30 and the Roman commander arresting Paul in verse 33, actually the same word in Greek. It's a bit like the Jews run towards Paul in verse 30 and the Romans run towards Paul in verse 32. A bit like the Jews shut the temple gates at once in verse 30, and the Roman tribune takes the soldiers with him at once in verse 32. It's a bit like the city is stirred up in verse 30 and the tribune comes up in verse 33. It's a bit like the Jews assert who Paul was and what he had done in verse 28 and the tribune asks who Paul was and what he had done in verse 33. It's a bit like Paul is dragged by the Jews in verse 30 and carried by the Romans in verse 35. In each case, being transported against his will. That's pretty deliberate, right? All of those parallels. And in all of those ways, Luke is dramatically contrasting the Jews with the Romans, Jewish injustice and Roman justice. And that's going to be a huge theme for the rest of the book. And the point is this. Here's the point. When we are faithful and stand up for Jesus, we should expect injustice, as illustrated by the Jews, but we should also know that we actually have right on our side, as illustrated by the Romans. When we stay faithful to Christ and stand by biblical views, biblical values, which can be increasingly unpopular in today's world, we should expect to be falsely accused and misinterpreted, misrepresented, not given a fair hearing. Let's not be shocked and surprised and blindsided when that happens. But we should also know that the gospel is good and right and true. And when it's subjected to honest examination, it will always emerge in a good light. We have right on our side. And so as we graciously, winsomely contend for biblical truth in a world that instinctively hates it, and often fight dirty to oppose it, we don't need to back down. Doesn't mean we become jerks about it. We stay winsome and gracious, but we don't need to back down. There will be injustice. We do have right on our side. And then the other contrast in these verses, as I said, is chaos and control. Chaos and control. At first, everything just seems like unmitigated chaos here, doesn't it? Look at all the verbs. Very dramatic. The city is stirred up in verse 30. All the people run together, and they seize Paul, and they drag him out of the temple, and at once the gates are shut. And while they're trying to kill Paul, the tribune sees that everything's in confusion. 31. And at once takes soldiers, verse 32, and runs down to the crowd. And in verse 34, some of the crowd are shouting one thing and some another, and the tribune can't even hear what people are saying because of the deafening uproar. And in 35, the soldiers have to carry Paul away because of the violence. And in verse 36, what had been called a crowd, Luke is now calling it what it is. It's become an out-of-control, wild mob. It is pure chaos, isn't it? In which Paul seems like a helpless, passive object, tossed from pillar to post, caught in a tug of war between the Jews and the Romans. He's like a kite in a hurricane. And yet, in the midst of it all, underneath the surface, if you look a little more closely, God's quiet, perfect, sovereign control is operating. All of this is according to plan. Paul is treading in exactly the footsteps of his master, the Lord Jesus, which is all he wants to do. As signaled for us, when the Jews scream at Paul in verse 36, exactly what Luke recorded them screaming at Jesus at his trial, away with him. We've known since chapter 20 in the book of Acts, Paul is going to be arrested by the Jews and then taken by the Romans. It's right according to plan. This now is exactly what is happening. If we've been paying close attention as we read, we were waiting for this to happen. Now it's happening. God's in control. In the midst of the chaos. So if there's chaos in your life, maybe relational chaos or some other kind of chaos, because you're standing up for Christ and being faithful, and it's very costly, be reassured. In the midst of the chaos, God is in control. Well, just before I close in prayer, let me share this. Joseph Tson was a Romanian pastor who was exiled by the Romanian communist government in 1981 for his faithfulness. And he tells this story. He says, I had a man in an important position whom I baptized come to me and ask, now what should I do? They will convene 3,000 or 4,000 people to expose me and mock me. They will give me 5 minutes to defend myself. How should I do it? Brother, I told him, defending yourself is the only thing you shouldn't do. This is your unique chance to tell them who you were before and what Jesus made of you, who Jesus is and what he is for you now. His face shone, and he said, Brother Joseph, I know what I'm going to do. And he did it well, so well that afterwards he was severely demoted. He lost almost half of his salary. But he kept coming to me after that, saying, Brother Joseph, you know, I cannot walk into that factory now without someone coming up to me. Wherever I go, someone pulls me into a corner, looks around to see that no one else will see him talking to me, and then whispers, give me the address of your church, or tell me more about Jesus, or do you have a Bible for me? There will be injustice, but we have right on our side, and there will be chaos, apparent chaos, but God is in control, working through it to fulfill his perfect purposes. How might he use you?